The meeting of the Healthcare Workforce Commission will now come to order. Today is Monday, November 14th, 2016. And we'd like to welcome those in the audience and commission members. We have people that will be joining us shortly that are tied up in other meetings. Special welcome to Representative Zerwas, who's to my left. He will be part of the report a little bit further down in the agenda. I'd like to begin by approving the minutes from our October meeting. Do I have an approval? So move, Senator Wicklund. Part of that minute identified that our next meeting will be on December 6th from 10 to 12 o'clock. And that will probably be our last public meeting. We will be doing some additional work via emails within the commission membership. But if you are looking at some further testimony, we will have available time on the 6th of December. And then also written comments can be submitted up until December 15th. I'm going to call upon Mr. Schoenbaum at this time to review our work plan. And also we'll be doing an update on the workforce effects of the nursing facility reimbursement charges and changes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mark Schoenbaum from the Health Department. Members, this work plan table has not changed. I guess it's changed a little bit since last time. We are in meeting three. You will see that as part of today's meeting, there will be a first discussion of the final report and potential priorities for that report. The plan is that we will do a priority setting exercise via email between meetings, as you did last year. Those priorities will be reviewed with the co-chairs, folded into a draft report for commission review at the December 6th meeting. And then, as we've just heard, meeting five will not happen, but there will be another round of email review to finalize and adopt the report. You've got some content, some topic areas on today's agenda, as well as public testimony. Same thing for the December 6th meeting. And unless there are questions, that's kind of where we stand in the process.
Any questions from commission members? Please note on the agenda that we will be having further discussion on this item number five, the final report outline and priorities. We will be having discussion a little bit later in the meeting today. With that, Mr. Schoenbaum, can you talk a little bit about the 2015 nursing facility reimbursement changes?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, you will find a memo from the Department of Human Services in your packets on their letterhead from Assistant Commissioner Coleman. You heard last year and a little this year about about the workforce effects, if any, of the major nursing home reform that took place in 2015. You had asked for a report out on those effects by the Department of Human Services. What this memo reports to us is that because those changes are just going into effect, it is too early to be able to have any update on workforce effects, if any, of those changes, at least on a kind of on a systematic DHS level supported by any reports or data at this time. Of course, you have heard reports from employers, you know, on what they're seeing and doing, but we don't yet have any kind of agency report out from the Department of Human Services.
Any questions or comments? Seeing none, we'll move on to item two on the agenda, scope of practice, and we're going to have an update, but just a little bit of background. The National Governors Association and National Conference of State Legislators sponsored a project on advancing scope of practice policies, and this initiative is in response to anticipated shortages in the healthcare workforce. As we know, demographics are changing not only here in Minnesota but across the nation. So at this time, I'd like to call on Ms. Block from the National Governors Association and Kate Blackman. Thank you for being with us today. And if you could identify yourselves and then provide the information we're asking for. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Lauren Block with the National Governors Association.
And I'm Kate Blackman with the National Conference of State Legislatures.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm a program director at the National Governors Association Center for Best Practices. And the NGA is a bipartisan membership organization that is for all governors. The NGA Center is a separate 501c3 organization that's entirely grant-funded. Within the center, we have five divisions, including the health division, where this project was sponsored. The healthcare workforce issues are some of the biggest issues that we handle and are one of the core six focus areas in which we work. In 2014 and 2015, we worked with several states to evaluate their existing healthcare workforce initiatives, and Minnesota participated in the project. As a logical follow-on, we designed a project in 2015 in conjunction with the National Conference of State Legislatures to help states evaluate healthcare workforce needs in relation to scope of practice policies. And we initiated the project to work across the executive and legislative branches to help build consensus through shared learning and evaluation of policies to help states address workforce shortages, cost containment objectives, and changes in the way that modern healthcare is being delivered. We know that scope of practice issues are highly contentious and frequently result in long and drawn-out battles between professions to simultaneously ensure patient safety, address unmet workforce needs, and ensure that professionals work in complementary ways that may overlap but don't unnecessarily duplicate if there is already a sufficient workforce. As you mentioned, Governor Dayton submitted an application as part of a competitive process to participate in this program, which includes members from both the executive and legislative branches. The application called for the development of a consensus evaluation framework that would strive to give entities bringing proposals to the legislature an opportunity to provide consistent, objective, and comprehensive information to inform decision-making, including an evaluation of opposition perspectives and engagement with opposition before submission. The NGA Center and NCSL has met monthly with the core group of stakeholders that represent the state and several healthcare workforce professions, including medicine, nursing, pharmacy, and dentistry, to develop the initial framework for consideration by a broader stakeholder group. We helped convene almost 70 stakeholders representing education, training, policy, and practice to conduct an in-depth analysis of the framework and incorporated feedback to develop the product here before you today. Thank you. My colleague, Kate Blackman, our partner from NCSL, would like to now provide a few more insights about the project.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Kate Blackman. I'm a senior policy specialist at the National Conference of State Legislatures. And as I hope our legislators in the room know, we are your organization. We are a national bipartisan organization that serves the legislatures of all 50 states and the territories. So all 7,383 state legislators and around 30,000 legislative staff are members of NCSL. We provide policy research, analysis, and technical assistance such as this around policy areas ranging from health and human services to transportation and criminal justice. And we also provide other support to the states. And like the NGA Center, we don't advocate for specific policy proposals, but we do seek to support states in achieving your own goals. And so as you alluded to, we at NCSL were really interested in this project with the NGA Center and with the Minnesota team because we consistently hear from our members about the need to address healthcare workforce shortages and meet the needs of rural and underserved communities in their states. And we know that legislators each year consider thousands of bills directly related to scope of practice. In fact, scope of practice is among the top five subjects of health bills in legislatures across the country each year. So, for example, in 2010-2011, NCSL tracked 1,795 scope of practice bills in 54 jurisdictions. As Lauren said, we recognize that scope of practice policies can become contentious, and this team here in Minnesota created this tool, this new framework, with the goal of having it be an objective resource to you as state legislators as you consider policy proposals. We know that several professions are already using the draft framework to think through potential policies, which is a good sign regarding the potential utility of the tool. And we know that the team is interested in hearing your feedback, and we at NCSL and at NGA are definitely interested in seeing how you may use it and how it may evolve over time, as it may be a future resource to other states. In fact, NCSL this month is launching a new scope of practice website, scopeofpracticepolicy.org, which will feature nonpartisan information on scope of practice issues, state legislation, and other state action. And we hope that we may be able to feature this work here from the team in Minnesota on this site for other states to learn from your experience. So we look forward to seeing how it goes, and on behalf of the NGA Center and NCSL, we look forward to supporting your work. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for your overview. Commission members, any questions for Ms. Block, Ms. Blackman this time? I should say that this has been about a year in the making. It's been about a 12-month process in developing this instrument that we'll be reviewing today, and I greatly appreciate your input and guidance in, as we went through that process. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
I wanted to take some time today to look at actually the instrument, the framework that we're talking about here. And so we've invited Ms. Moebi from the Minnesota Department of Health, if she'd come forward and walk us through the framework, that would be appreciated. And again, if you could identify yourself for the tape.
Maybe I did something. Oh, there we go.
Good morning, Chairman, Mr. Chair, members of the Commission. My name is Nithika Moebi. I'm with the Department of Health, Division of Health Policy, Office of Rural Health and Primary Care. I'm grateful to our national partners, NG and NCSL, for helping us navigate this project that we've been very interested in. They've given us a nice overview, and now I'll just walk us through some of the tools that were developed as part of this project. Just a little more about the project itself. We were encouraged by the Governor's Office to apply for this project back in the summer of 15. And the project was officially kicked off in the fall of 15, and since then, we along with the core team, has been steering this project forward. You have handouts in your folder about this project, and I'll just have us walk through slide number 9 very quickly to give you an overview of our state team that were part of the state team that helped steer this work forward. There was representation from the health licensing boards, as well as employers and educators and bipartisan legislative members. I also want to recognize that there are a couple core team members in attendance today. See Representative Zerwas is joining us. There's also representation from boards of medical practice and nursing. Representative Zerwas, would you like to maybe make a comment or two about the project and your participation?
Yeah, and I'll be brief. It was a pleasure to serve with Senator Klassen and others, other members of the legislature, on this committee as we worked in the core team to try to find a way to streamline this process and I think try to flesh out what can be at times kind of contentious discussions and try to find a way to focus those discussions on really the issues at hand. And I think as we go through and see kind of the resources and the tool developed, my hope is that as we've reached out to stakeholders, legislators, former legislators, individuals from the governor's team that we have a process moving forward that can, as best we can, take some of the emotion out of what can be sometimes a personal, sometimes emotionally charged, sometimes kind of divisive process, and focus on really what the goals are at hand. And I think a lot of credit needs to be given to Nika and to Mark Schoenbaum for their work in the Department of Health in leading this team through, along with NGA and NCSL. This wouldn't have been possible without your efforts. And so thank you for your guidance and your help.
Thank you. It was a team effort. And I should mention, Senator Clausen, you yourself were part of our core team too. So thank you to all who were participating. So just an overview about our project. I'll walk us through the tools, and then we'd be open to some Q&A from you. When we developed our application to submit to the NGA, there were three main components of our application. The first one was to develop a consensus document or some kind of a framework for legislators to evaluate the scope of practice bills that come to them for the exact same reasons that our partners just outlined. It's contentious, it's turfy, there are lots of voices to hear from. And so we've developed what we think is a beginning tool to sort through some of the noise and the voices that you hear, and I'll walk us through that in just a moment. It's a two-part framework. It's intended to be used by part one is intended to be used by those who are actually proposing the bill, and part two is an evaluative tool that's intended for use by you and your staff as you're evaluating the bill that's coming in front of you. If I can have you turn your attention to a handout in your packet titled Framework for Describing and Evaluating Scope of Practice and or New Licensure Proposals for Policymakers. This is the tool that we've developed. It's a two-part tool. Part one, as I said, is for the party that's proposing the bill. And it has eight domains. These domains are around public safety and well-being, access, cost, quality implications, regulation, education and professional supervision, finance issues, workforce impacts, and to demonstrate that proposers have worked through the opponents and with the parties that are opposing the bill and provide demonstrate about that, and some reporting procedures. Mr. Chairman, would you like me to walk through some of the details, the sub-questions on each of the domains?
Yes, please. I appreciate that.
So I'm looking at page 2 of the handout. This is the section that provides the details about the proposal. The first domain is public safety and well-being. And there are about 2 to 5 sub-questions under each domain. And I'm happy to read this along as it has in front of you, too. The first is describe using evidence to the extent possible how the proposed scope and regulation may improve or may harm the health, safety, and welfare of the public. And any research evidence available that the proposed change might have a risk to the public that should be cited. Will a regulatory entity or board have the authority to discipline practitioners? And describe any proposed disciplinary measures to safeguard against unethical or unfit professionals, and how can consumers access this information? The second domain is around cost, access, cost, quality, care transformation implications. Describe how the proposed changes will affect the availability, accessibility, cost, and delivery of quality healthcare. Describe the unmet healthcare needs of the population. Describe whether the scope of practice includes provisions to encourage practitioners to serve underserved populations. A description of whether the proposal contributes to the evolving healthcare delivery and payment system models in front of us. Under regulation, if the services or individuals are currently unregulated, what is the proposed form of credentialing and regulation and the rationale for the proposed form of regulation? A description of whether a regulatory entity currently exists or if it will be proposed, and what kinds of rules related to the change or the expansion need to be determined regarding education, training programs, assessment of competence, etc. We also want to know if there's any model legislation available at the national level, and if so, which organization has provided it, and whether other states have adopted it or not. There's also information on whether there's overlap with scope of practice laws with other professions or practitioners. This is often the point of great contention And this question is included with the sentiment that that implies that any overlap, if there is present, it isn't negative. Under education and professional supervision, there's information to provide on the training, education, experience that will be required of this professional based on the proposals. And if programs are available, if programs are not available, what is the plan to make them available, and are they accredited and approved? Do provisions exist, or are they going to be proposed to ensure that practitioners maintain a level of competency in their field? Is there a recommended level of supervision that's proposed for this practitioner, and the terms of it would be stated? Under reimbursement and financial impact, the proposing party would need to provide information on how and who will compensate this new emerging service and professional, and what reimbursements are available in other states for similar work, and any projected regulatory costs to state government, and any potential revenue that would be offsetting those costs, and some more information about the proposed fiscal impact of the bill. There's also space to inform the legislators about the workforce impacts of the proposal, such as what is known about the projected supply, how many individuals are expected to practice, the geographic availability of the proposed individuals, any evidence about the new and modified proposal and how it will impact the supply of the proposed services. Under supporters and opponents, the sponsors of the proposers are strongly encouraged to understand and attempt to address the concerns of the opposition before submitting the proposed document. We want to know what organizations and groups have developed and reviewed the proposal, any organizations and positions that they are taking, information about the professions seeking regulation and approximate numbers that would be impacted in Minnesota, any anticipated or early documented position of professional associations, and actions taken to minimize any potential conflict or disagreement with those opposing it, and also what consumer and advocacy groups may support and oppose the proposal and why. There's also a provision to provide a report to the legislature about its progress and subsequent impacts. So this is part one of the proposal that the body that's proposing the bill would be expected to fill out. And part two is sort of a summary level note or a worksheet for the bill evaluators, the legislators themselves. And here, this is a place to kind of just make some high level notes about what you may have read in the proposal, any outstanding questions that you may have, or any additional gaps that you may see that you'd like to have addressed. And so it captures each of the eight domains and some space to make some notes about it. And then some additional provisions, such as if the bill promotes health equity, or how it may positively impact the constituents in your area as you're reviewing the proposal. So this is a draft of our tool, and we're looking to kind of refine this further to see how it best meets your informational needs, and if you have any input, I'm happy to take that now or at a later time, however members would want to get us some feedback. There was also, like I mentioned, there were three parts to our application. The second part of our proposal was to look at to assess some of the barriers to recently enacted scope of practice laws that have happened, and see what kind of help develop an action plan and identify strategies to help mitigate those barriers. And to that end, we developed another worksheet or a tool that is also in your handout. It would be titled Barriers Assessment Form for Scope of Practice Changes. It's a two-pager, front and back. And this form is designed to be used by those who are intending to look at how far they've gotten from where they wanted to go when a scope was proposed. And they can list, provide an overview of the profession. The form itself has space to do that and describe the actual change that has happened and what was the overall goal of the change. And then try to identify and work through some of the barriers that were identified. Look at the type of barrier it was and what kind of an action plan or strategy needs to be put in place and who needs to be the actor of that strategy so groups can make sort of an action plan to move forward and mitigate the barriers, along with information on timeline, measures of progress, etc., and the ultimate impact and benefits so they don't lose track of the larger picture and the goal of the change. Another part of our proposal was to identify some of the proposals for the 2017 session. And I'll get to that in just a moment, and before that, I'll just tell you how we arrived at this information. In August of 2016, on August 30th, we had a public stakeholder meeting where we invited about 68 attendees at the Normandale Community College, and we have them kind of review this, deconstruct and unpack this form, and tell us what their reactions were to it. And we, NG and NCSL, helped us in real-time process that feedback, and we made changes to the form. And at that meeting, there were legislators present, licensing boards, professional associations, educators, employers, lobbyists. And at that time for the meeting registration, we asked the attendees if they would submit to us any potential proposals they were considering for 2017. And so you should have in your packet a list of potential 17 proposals we received from that group. There were proposals submitted by the interpreting stakeholder group, the Board of Psychology, the Physician Assistant Academy, the APRN Coalition, Dental Hygienist Association, the Minnesota Healthcare Safety Net Coalition, the Behavioral Analysts, and Normandale Community College Pharmacists Association, and the University of Minnesota College of Pharmacy. And I understand that a couple of these will be presenting or speaking to you after this. So here is our core team, as I mentioned. And that was the extent of our work as we had proposed for it to be. I'm happy to take any questions or any feedback that you may have about any of the tools.
Any comments from commission members? None? Yes, Senator Halverson.
Really just a comment. I think this is really a great great framework, and I don't have any immediate questions, but might after I kind of think it through based on some bills I've worked on in the past. But it seems very comprehensive, and I think it's really a great idea to have this so that we can cover a lot more ground before the bill gets introduced, and then not find out things further along in the process. So I'm sure there will be things that come up along the way. Maybe you could just describe, I just had a question, this barriers assessment form, kind of who would be the users of this form? Could you just describe it again?
Yeah, sure, Mr. Chair, Senator Wicklund. Thank you for your words and your question. I should say when we were working on this framework, we borrowed intellectually from Statute 214 that's currently on the books for Minnesota, and that really helped inform the direction and the shape of our thinking. Also, there has been a consensus document that was published in 2006 by the National Healthcare Associations that had physical therapy, pharmacy, medicine, nursing, and that too helped provide some guiding principles. So So I think there's some precedent for this kind of work and need for the legislators to have some kind of a tool. And so I'd be happy to get any feedback from you later. I know this was a lot to go through right now. To your question about the barriers assessment framework, so as we were working through our project, we had asked one of the members from the Board of Nursing to kind of just use this and test drive it for us, and they used the recent APRN bill that was passed and identified what were some barriers that were still remaining, and so this could be used by someone as sort of as a post-mortem on a statute that has already happened, but even proactively, if someone is thinking of making a barrier change, they could proactively have a work plan and anticipate some potential barriers that would come in place and what kind of a strategy or action plan they might need to have ahead of time. So in the first case, as I mentioned, our Board of Nursing members were able to kind of describe the APRN bill that was passed and some of the remaining, some of the work that still has to be done to fully meet the spirit of the law that was intended for it to be. And so I think they found this form useful in identifying the barriers, identifying the actors of it and what the strategy should be, what kind of a timeline would they want to have, and how to make progress on that. Does that help answer your question? Okay.
Thank you. Having been part of the process along with Representative Zerwas, I know that we've vetted this on a couple of occasions going through and taken recommendations. But again, this is a draft. We'd be interested today in any comments that people in the audience might have. And then also, as I mentioned before, we'll taking written comments through the 15th of December. So there will be opportunity for people to react to this, if you would. Any other comments, questions? Yeah, Representative Zerwas.
I guess Senator Klassen, I would just add that I think kind of everything is a best laid plan until the first time you use it. And so I think we've tried, after it's been constructed, to kind of go back in time through some of the recent scope of practice discussions we've had in the legislature. I think there's also, as we look at the session ahead, this is something that I hope chairs of the committee will lean on and rely upon, just for the base amount of information that you can get about a proposal out of the framework and out of the tool. But I don't think this is the end-all, be-all. I think as much as we try, these scope of practice issues are extremely contentious. They're almost always talking about one group of individuals doing something they couldn't do before and possibly eating into someone else's backyard. And so they're kind of ripe for conflict. And so I think my hope is that this type of level set and tool, if used by the appropriate chairs moving forward, can do the best that we can to gather up facts, gather up information ahead of time, and try to get a level factual playing field for these types of debates and these types of issues, which in my experience can be kind of difficult to have with these types of issues. You have generally a group of individuals that say, if we do this, it's going to solve this access issue. And you have another group of people say, if you do this, here's the wake of destruction that will be left behind. And it's usually pretty that contrast. And so my hope is that if ahead of time, before the emotions of it get in play, you can kind of lay out kind of some neutral ground and some fact-based narratives, I'm hoping that that would help move the discussions forward.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Zerwas. I think, too, that one of the things that it provides a framework of information for us to make better decisions as we move ahead. So greatly appreciate the work that you have done and also the members of the committee that worked on this. So thank you very much.
Thank
greatly
you.
Appreciated. With that, I think it would be good if we could have a recommendation for acceptance from this group that what we have currently in front of us that we accept, and knowing that this is not, as Representative Zerwas said, the end-all, but that we do accept this report, we accept the instrument in its current form, and that we move ahead. If we can just have a consensus, a nodding of heads would be all right. Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
At this time, we will have testimony on potential 2017 scope of practice potential bills. The first group up, Minnesota Athletic Trainers Association. Representatives could come forward. Amy Brugge and Brent Milliken. And again, if you could identify yourselves as you begin. And thank you for being here today.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
I am Amy Brugge. I am the chair of the Governmental Affairs Committee for the Minnesota Athletic Trainers Association. And this is?
Brent Milliken, and I manage sports medicine services within Sports North Peak Specialist, part of Allina Health.
As mentioned, we are one of the groups that is considering moving forward with a scope of practice bill for the 2017 session. The Minnesota Athletic Trainers Act was enacted in 1993, requiring athletic trainers to register through the Board of Medical Practice. We are now numbered at over 1,000 providers in the state. For those that are not familiar with athletic trainers are not personal trainers or fitness specialists, who commonly are unregulated as a profession in most states. Instead, athletic trainers are healthcare professionals who render services for treatment under the direction or in collaboration with a physician as part of a healthcare team. They provide prevention, education, emergent care, clinical diagnosis, therapeutic intervention, and rehabilitation of injuries and medical conditions related to physical activity in accordance with state statutes. In the 23 years since the Registration Act for Athletic Trainers was passed here in Minnesota, healthcare has changed dramatically, as has the professional preparation of athletic trainers here in the United States. At the time that our statutes went into effect, athletic trainers did not have to complete a specific bachelor's degree in athletic training, simply a related degree with a corresponding internship with a prerequisite number of practice hours. Today, all athletic trainers must complete either a bachelor's degree or a master's degree from an accredited program. And by 2022, all new providers will be required to complete their entry-level degree at the master's level. So why would we pursue updating the existing Athletic Trainers Act? Well, the current statutes are for a registration, not licensure. As you can see by the regulatory map, and you might have got one that was black and white, so it might be harder to see, but if you have a color one, the regulatory map provided in your materials shows that this is not on par with how most of the nation has elected to regulate athletic trainers. And, well, why would that matter? Licensure provides for title protection. The Board of Medical Practice asserts that registration is a less restrictive form of credentialing that deems an individual qualified to practice and to use the title, but that others may engage in the practice provided that they simply don't use the profession's title. Legislatures across the nation have deemed licensure to be the appropriate level of credentialing, but yet here in Minnesota, we have not. And that affects public safety. The healthcare professional who provides care and services to your children at a sporting event should be licensed as an athletic trainer. The second reason to consider a scope of practice update is around the existing statutes and their lack of a standalone definition for athletic training. The provisions embedded within statutes outline an outdated scope that limits athletic trainers to providing services only to athletes and not patients. Small changes in words, but that matters when it comes to providing care. The language within the statutes say that athletic trainers may only render services for athletic injuries sustained as a result of participation in exercise, sports, games, or recreation. But what if that condition is not sustained, but instead exacerbated by physical activity? What if that condition is a sudden illness, like heat stroke, or a medical condition, like exercise-induced asthma, and not necessarily an athletic injury? And what if that patient is not an athlete in the standard sense of someone participating in sports wearing a uniform, but is instead a baggage handler at MSP who's receiving preventative care to protect against the development of musculoskeletal conditions? Or perhaps a busy mom individually training for a marathon who's looking to return to her full level of functional activity after suffering an ankle sprain doing something simple like stepping off a curb at the grocery store. Those patient access questions occur in our state's healthcare organizations when attempting to direct a patient to the appropriate care provider due to the low-level scope language in the existing Athletic Trainers Practice Act. Meanwhile, if that mother of three who suffered an ankle sprain wants to return to her full active training level, lives in Stillwater, and decides to drive across the border to Wisconsin, their innovative and current scope of practice language allows for healthcare organizations there to deliver athletic training services within rehabilitation departments because athletic trainers in Wisconsin can evaluate and treat patients, not just athletes, and take care of injuries and illnesses related to physical activity. So the access issue is one piece, and athletic trainers do not simply work in sports-related settings. The narrow scope of language in Minnesota, despite that, there are individuals, like the people at Sports and Orthopedic Specialists, who have found on a small scale, ways of employing athletic trainers in ambulatory and rehabilitation clinics or industrial and occupational health settings. But that innovation is being limited because those organizations have to continually ask themselves, can we employ an athletic trainer in this way or that way or allow them to do that? The Bureau of Labor Statistics predicts an overall increase of 21.1% in athletic trainer employment by 2024, with an estimated 46.9% growth in the ambulatory care sector. Minnesota will not be home to this positive growth, particularly in our rural regions, if the state is not positioned for innovative incorporation of athletic trainers in the healthcare system due to their outdated Practice Act. So it's for these reasons that the Minnesota Athletic Trainers Association intends to advocate for modification to the Practice Act that will include a current definition of athletic training that would say, the provision of care for the prevention, recognition, evaluation, management, rehabilitation, and reconditioning of human ailments sustained or exacerbated by physical activity, or that limits the patient or client's full return to functional physical activities and wellness. We know that the 1,000 credentialed providers is a small voice in this vast land of healthcare reform. We've been advocating for these word changes and definitional changes for over a decade. So it's exciting to see that form about barriers to scope of practice change. We hope that the legislature will be willing to hear and consider our bill to enable athletic trainers to practice at the highest level of their credential and appropriately serve patients across the state on par with their educational preparation.
Thank you.
Well, again, thank you for giving us an opportunity to come and testify today. I think as we all know, as healthcare, as we continue to evolve, we are transitioning to a value care model that includes integrative care. It's extremely important that healthcare providers are allowed to practice at the top of their education and scope for the patients they serve. Allina Health employs nearly 70 full-time athletic trainers. Allina Health has recognized the value of using an athletic trainer in clinic working directly with the physician seeing patients. This includes rooming the patient, gathering initial history, reviewing past medical and surgical history, review of systems, known allergies, current medications, past family medical and surgical history along with their social history, and then also initiating the exam. The athletic trainer then also will document and scribe the clinic note per the physician's visit. They submit orders. They do a whole bunch of other aspects involved in that patient care. This collaborative and comprehensive care model has allowed the physicians to focus on what they need to do in terms of the patient care component, but also allows it to help specifically sports and orthopedic specialists in the clinics, a line of health clinics that utilize athletic trainers to increase their patient satisfaction scores, as we've recently been recognized in the top 10% nationally of willingness to recommend. And we are attributing a lot of that to this comprehensive care model utilizing the athletic trainers. Athletic trainers are also used in some of our clinics in the physical therapy setting, and many provide outreach to the community, providing care to the college, high school, and amateur and youth sports teams. Regardless of the setting, we're treating patients, and we're working directly with patients. I'm fortunate to work for an organization that's willing to allow us to use our athletic trainers in direct patient care. When sports and orthopedic specialists joined Allina Health in 2010, I did have to sit down and have several meetings with various departments within Allina, including our human resources, risk and safety, compliance, and coding, explaining the role of the athletic trainer, reviewing our educational competencies, and our Practice Act. There are questions about the patient population we treat based on the wording in our Practice Act, and I was able to convince them it is within our scope based on our educational competencies, and the current language is outdated. Specifically, when we talk about in our current language, it talks about we treat athletes versus patients. And ultimately, when you're a healthcare provider, you're treating patients. Unfortunately, this is not the case in other situations for other athletic trainers. Our current language indicating we treat the athletes and athletic injuries is confusing to many employers of athletic trainers, therefore restricting them from being able to practice at the top of their license. In addition to how healthcare has evolved, so has our education, as Amy's talked about. The education of the athletic trainer is overseen by CATE, the Commission on Accreditation of Athletic Training Education, which is made up of representation from the American Academy of Family Physicians, the American Academy of Pediatrics, American Orthopedic Society for Sports Medicine, and the National Athletic Trainers Association. CATE establishes the educational competencies for our profession, and those as healthcare, again, continue to evolve, has evolved as well. I think utilizing the athletic trainer in their areas of expertise and being able to practice in that capacity is going to be good for healthcare, for the points that I've just talked about, for the points that Amy alluded to, especially in, you know, here in the Twin Cities, you have resources that are much more readily available. But I think when you look in the rural communities and such, being able to utilize everyone at the top of their practice act is going to be crucial as we continue to provide cost-efficient health care. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Comments? Yes, Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So I have a couple questions for you. One of them is in reading about the terminology in existing statutes. So what I'm gathering from this is that, say, a patient wanted to have a recovery maybe or something like that or treatment, does a patient have the choice of an athletic trainer or another service provider? Are you able to be one of the choices in that situation?
Ms. Brugge?
That will vary. Thank you. That will vary between healthcare organizations. Some healthcare organizations in Minnesota will not allow for the choice. They will simply direct the patient based upon questions during a scheduling process, and others will. So the confusion around the terminology of the patient versus athlete will sometimes cause a healthcare organization to say, was this injury sustained during a game, during an event? Are you an athlete? And if the answers there are no, they may be rerouted to another rehabilitation service provider.
Okay. Another question.
Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you very much. Okay, that's helpful. And the other question I have for you is whether I noticed on the map there's licensing and there's registration. Minnesota's a registration state, and I did get it in color.
Great.
And it is so much easier
yes.
when you have it in color to pick those things out. So the question I have for you, though, is in your reimbursement or in working through some of those things, do the health insurance or whatever providers make a distinction whether you are licensed or registered?
Currently, there is variation on that by state. And in Minnesota, being registered has not even really allowed most healthcare organizations to pursue the conversation of reimbursement for athletic training services. Technically, registered providers, regardless of what the profession is, could be reimbursed for their services, but it's an easy way to start the denial process by saying you are not licensed.
Thank you very much.
I'd like to follow up. I think it's also some of the interpretation around athlete and patient in our current practice act. When they in a current practice act says athlete versus patient, how are those payers identifying, trying to differentiate between who that consumer of the services, where do they fall into that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I kind of see this as, you know, they are kind of licensing and registration, and I appreciate that answer to that, and also the language of patient versus athlete. And I'm just a big believer in having everybody who is qualified and all goes through all of that for patients, giving them that choice and being able to have everybody function as full as they can under their scope. But so, Mr. Chair, what we're doing right now is just having a presentation of information on this. There is no action item on our agenda for this subject at this time?
That's correct. We're okay. Just taking testimony, and I think I'd like a follow-up. You had a chance to listen to the scope of practice framework that's been presented. Do you have any comments on that as far as your use of that as you pursue the scope of practice in your area?
Thank you, Chairman. We were excited to see that framework written out. We were not one of the stakeholder groups invited to that August 30th meeting. So to be able to see what the department has put together was good for us to think how we can best provide information to both the Senate and the House of Representatives going forward. As Representative Zerwas noted, these things can be contentious, and to have a level-headed, factual dialogue will always be important. And so we're excited to be able to use that as a guide as we put proposals forward.
Very good. Any other comments, questions? Senator Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So in hearing this, that means that this assessment form for scope of practice, while you weren't included in that. Is this something you want to be included in, would like to be included? I'm just a little bit uncertain as to why we would exclude anybody, and that we ought to at least have the response and the information before us. If we can request that being done, I don't know if it's in process or kind of where it's at, but I certainly want to include people.
Sure. Representative Zerwas.
Well, and I can, Mr. Chair, Senator Kiffmeyer, and I can just briefly lay out. I think we had 68 attendees. We're working within kind of a facility issue to hold everyone and do breakouts and move people around and try to get the work done in a day. I feel that over the year this has been a very mm-hmm. inclusive process, and I think as we've said, I think a couple times already today, that there's this is draft two, but final draft one, as it's being used, and I think certainly those of us on the core team are very open to feedback from different stakeholder mm-hmm. groups and individuals participating. And my guess is, as this is utilized, if it's picked up by incoming chairs and it's utilized throughout its first legislative session, my gut tells me we'll get a lot of feedback and response after that process. And I think I wouldn't be surprised if some components of the core team came back together after a session of use to reevaluate the tools and see how it's meeting its needs and where it might be falling short and making some adjustments or amendments at that time. But I just want to be clear that as the Department of Health and NGA and NCSL set up that group and got people in, I, for one, was surprised that 68 people wanted to talk about scope of practice for 7 hours on an August afternoon. I thought only I would want to do that, but it was great to see that much interest, and those discussions will continue in as the most inclusive way possible.
Thank you. I think those are good comments. Again, we're open to feedback from people, and hopefully you'll take advantage of that. You know, a good example is this is kind of a typical hearing that we would have in the past, where you present your information, and then we hear from the other side, and we're left up in the air. How do we make this decision? We're really hoping that this instrument will provide more definition, give us just more information for us to make a decision. So, again, thank you for being here today. We appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
We have another group, Minnesota Association of Naturopathic Physicians, are with us today. And again, as you come forward, if you could identify yourself. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members. My name is Dr. Sarah Jean Barrett, and I'm a naturopathic doctor and president of the MNA, the Minnesota Association of Naturopathic Physicians. Naturopathic doctors are registered under 147E, which was passed in 2008 and signed by Governor Tim Pawlenty. At that time, many compromises were made, including registration instead of licensure, a much narrower scope of practice than in other states. We've waited 8 years before returning, and we've proven our safety record by having no disciplinary actions against NDs during that time. We are returning and ready to move forward to modernize our scope to accurately reflect our education and training. We're a small but growing profession. The number of NDs in the U.S. and Canada has increased by 91% from 2001 to 2006. NDs have been regulated in Washington State since 1919, Connecticut since 1920, Hawaii since 1925, Arizona since 1935, and currently 18 states and the District of Columbia regulate naturopathic doctors. Pennsylvania passed legislation 12 days ago. Right now, our scope is lacking the use of legend drugs, a practice that is allowed in 13 states currently. In these states, NDs have an excellent safety record for prescribing. In our framework, we've included safety statistics as well as a letter from the leading malpractice carrier for NDs attesting to our safety record. In fact, malpractice insurance with this carrier is 30% lower for NDs than MDs, partially because there's never been a malpractice claim opened for an ND relating to prescriptive drugs. Additionally, the vast majority of NDs practice in a primary care setting. The proposed updates to our scope would allow Minnesota to attract NDs to help fill the primary care gap. As of July 2010, 52.9% of Minnesota counties carried a full or partial health professional shortage area designation in primary care. Our framework outlines where NDs are currently practicing and our anticipated growth of NDs in Minnesota once we can practice to the full extent of our training. Additionally, NDs bridge the gap between alternative and conventional medicine. We are trained in and follow conventional standards of care. We often see patients who are distrustful of conventional medicine and can help them understand when conventional diagnostics and therapeutics are prudent. For example, we see a lot of children and have the credibility to talk to parents about the importance of vaccines. We appreciate you looking at the process for scope of practice proposals. We have used the framework to collect all information and provide a thorough justification for our licensure and updates to our suppressed scope. We are in the process of collecting feedback and talking with stakeholders. We intend to go through two rounds of revisions incorporating stakeholder feedback before the next session starts. The process is notoriously subjective and benefits professions with greater numbers in the state. For example, because Minnesota has a suppressed scope for NDs, when someone graduates from a natural lake medical school and is looking at where to practice, they'll choose a state that maximizes their impact. And because Minnesota only registers NDs, and because we lack prescribing rights, only 61 NDs are currently registered in Minnesota. That makes it hard to even have an association, let alone hire a lobbyist or pass a bill. This is a self-defeating cycle. So while the framework and process is good, it doesn't change the fact that powerful interest groups have an advantage against small groups. So I would encourage you to look at proposals brought by smaller groups carefully and make sure they're not being fenced out by larger groups. This is a very exciting time in healthcare, and Minnesotans deserve more choice in their healthcare providers. Thank you for your time and consideration. I'm happy to answer questions.
Thank you. Comments, questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Do we have others that would like to come forward? Yes, please do so. And again, please state your name and group that you're representing.
I don't have any overheads.
Okay.
My name is Julia Freed-Devine, and I am an RN, a public health nurse, and an international board-certified lactation consultant. And I'm here today because there's discussion, and this is an opportunity to talk about scope of practice. And there's a great deal of interest in our field to get us licensed as professionals. Separate from or over and above our training as registered nurses or public health nurses. So just want to give you a little history. And I have some copies of things to give you, Greg, afterwards. So my title at IBCLC stands for International Board Certified Lactation Consultant. And it's an international board certification. There are over 28,000 certificates around the world in 102 countries. There is a governing board. The governing board was established in 1985, and the certification exam has been administered in 21 different languages in more than 50 countries. And there's a National Commission of Certifying Agencies, which is a mark of quality for the certification process. To earn this, you must meet defined objective standards pertaining to numerous aspects of its program of the program in respect to the exam. And so this might be pertinent for other people who are looking at scope of practice too, instead of reinventing the wheel, as I was listening. The exam is based on professionals in the field, scientific disciplines such as maternal and infant anatomy, growth parameters, developmental milestones, chronological periods, and there's lactation consultants working in most hospitals around the country, or some hospitals. Some hospitals have lactation consultants that are board certified. Some have certified lactation educators. And I want to just point out that I was a certified lactation educator for a period of time prior to becoming an IBCLC. And there's really no criteria to maintain that credential other than the initial training. So a certified lactation educator versus an IBCLC have similar duties and scope of practice, but an IBCLC has standards of practice, educational requirements, and clinical experience required to take a board exam. The educational requirements depend how the person is starting out. As a registered nurse, I got to follow this pathway A, for example. If somebody was a dietitian or some other health professional, they would follow a different pathway. But the easiest way to become an IBCLC is to become an RN, because you'll have some you'll have a health foundation in nutrition, biology, anatomy, psychology, 14 subjects total. The requirement is 90 hours lactation-specific training within 5 years of taking a board exam. I'm just giving you a nutshell. 1,000 hours of lactation-specific practice supervised by someone familiar with breastfeeding within 5 years prior to taking the board exam. And that initial board certification is good for 5 years. Every 5 years, something has to happen. The initial time for recertification, an IBCLC to maintain the that title needs 75 continuing education hours with every 5 years. The subsequent time, they have to take the board exam again. So after the first 10 years after their first exam, they're required to take that same board exam. So, as far as scope of practice, there's just many details that I could tell you. Do you guys have any questions right off the bat from what I've said so far?
Any questions? Yes, Representative Zerwas.
I think for this group and the purpose of this meeting, most beneficial would be if you've reviewed the toolkit or the tool that's being proposed, and if you have any comments on the efficacy of that, and if that would help you better tell your story and present your case for licensure to the legislature.
Okay. How do I get to that point if I haven't previewed that prior to coming here today? Can this still be considered for 2017?
Oh, absolutely. I'm just saying, if you were here talking about the toolkit that was placed together, I was just wondering if you'd had an opportunity to review that or could provide some feedback on that.
I did not.
Okay.
I did discuss some of that with Greg Claussen. But, I am expecting that this, because it meets a national certification accreditation program guidelines, I'm guessing it would meet what has been established here. Is that for the state of Minnesota? Okay. So I'm guessing it's in line with some of the same language, but would have to go through it in detail to to clarify that.
Do you anticipate that your organization will be presenting something to the legislature this upcoming session?
I'm here as an individual. I am not representing an organization per se, but I'm representing a body of lactation consultants in the state of Minnesota that would like to see licensure. And I am part of the Metro Breastfeeding Coalition, part of the Minnesota Breastfeeding Coalition. And in my practice, this is something that is highly valuable to clients. People who are breastfeeding have healthier children. The women have lower risk of breast cancer. There's just a wide range of things that with limited service providers, it can, with increasing the ability for us to be licensed providers, we increase the expanse of our ability to help the community. So I have connections that I just wasn't able to get together to come today. People who are doing this outside of their primary job, as I am today, within these coalition groups. So we certainly can all come together to discuss further how it meets the criteria. Is that what I'm understanding we are?
Yes.
Okay.
What we would like is that you do take a look at that scope of practice framework document.
Okay.
And you look at that and complete that based upon your objectives, the criteria, the questions that are identified there. And then you could present that to the legislature for review and possible an enactment increasing the scope of practice for your group.
Okay.
Okay. Any other comments, questions? All right. Thank you so much.
Okay. Do you want me to give you this? Or?
Yes, please.
Okay.
Do we have anyone else in the audience that would like to provide testimony? Okay. Well, moving on then in our agenda, Merck program focused discussion, Mr. Schoenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm switching hats a couple of times today. Got my health department program manager hat on for the next section of the agenda here to talk about Merck. And you've got, I think, a handout of these slides, plus you've got the recent Merck program report to the legislature. Members, in each of your previous years, you've spent some time on the Merck program, which is clearly a complex program. I may be the manager of the program, but I'm regularly surprised by some of the nuances that we find. But nonetheless, you've been over the basics enough that I think where we ended at the last end of last year was to begin to ask the question, how do you as legislators kind of better use this program and these resources to accomplish the specific workforce goals and education and training goals that are your priorities? So that's the goal for this afternoon, is to take a quick look back through the basics. Again, we've been over those a couple of times. And then maybe just to lay out how you could begin to better think about that as a policy tool what some of those choices might be for you. I know there are others here that have an interest and expertise in the program. I especially want to acknowledge Dr. Michael Belzer, who has been the chair of the Merck Program Advisory Committee, just graduated from that position and is able to be with us today. So maybe first just kind of some recap on the basics. If you want me to stop, please do, and dive deeper. Otherwise, I'll just keep moving. So Merck provides funds to the providers you see here to subsidize part of their training costs. You can see what the kind of the policy principles are behind the Merck program. That third principle there under funding has one that has been central to the legislature's work over the last couple decades and creates many of the complications that make this a difficult tool, and that's to maximize federal contributions through the Medicaid program. Here's a list of the professions that are eligible for clinical education subsidy. And here's a big picture how the program works. So the program provides funds to training sites. The site must be a Medicaid provider because about half of the funds come from the Medicaid program. They must do training, so they must have trainees in these eligible occupations. Once those two prerequisites are met, they receive a share of the pool, which is now $59 million, based on their Medicaid revenue in comparison to the Medicaid revenue of all other applicants. There are a few outlier controls that are at work there, but that's the big picture. Here's the current year's funding for the program. You can see that kind of about halfway down the page, that $59,277,000 are the funds that go out through the formula I just discussed. It is a complex program, and you can see there's kind of lots of moving parts here. It's administered by the health department. The department receives kind of essential contributions from 20 sponsoring institutions that are either higher education institutions or large teaching hospitals. Because of the connection to Medicaid, the Department of Human Services plays the role. And ultimately, this past year, funds were distributed to 419 training sites. So who got the money? Where did it go? The really specific list is in the legislative report. But big picture, here's some category looks. Most of it went to hospitals, followed by physician clinics. Geographically, it goes in the Twin Cities and to Olmsted County, largely speaking, although some of it does go throughout the state. And here are the types of trainees that receive support through the program. Again, the largest group are medical residents and medical students, followed by advanced practice nurses and dental and pharmacy. So that is, again, that's kind of a breeze through the outline of the program. Last year we looked, and we'll look again in a minute, at how this distribution and funding matches up with the goals, the state's workforce policy goals, and in particular with the charge of this commission to look at primary care. And I think the quick answer is it matches up fairly imprecisely. and their members have expressed interest in how they might go about targeting those funds more precisely to meet primary care goals or any other policy goals that were of interest. And there's kind of three main ways to do that. One way, and the way that has been done, I think, exclusively over the last 20 years, is to tweak that current formula that is found in statute. That was done, I think, last in 2013, and we'll look at what happened there. Because the program is in some central ways a creature of Medicaid, to do that brings in not just the Department of Human Services, but the requirements of the federal government. So any changes must retain a close tie to Medicaid enrollees and Medicaid providers. The federal government, which is providing half the funds through the Medicaid program, requires that the funds be used for the benefit of the Medicaid program. So that is one parameter that kind of limits some of the room to move. Each change, even once enacted into law, must go through a federal approval process. Those are complicated and lengthy and uncertain. Regardless of what you put in statute, federal government has the last word. And there have been some recent changes. I don't know if they've come before the HHS committees yet in the federal regulations related to managed care and Medicaid goals. That may be a new complicating factor. Given all these variables, again, as you've seen over the years, anything you do or that you think you're doing is indirect and can't be precisely predicted. It can be generally predicted, and we do our darndest at the health department to run all kinds of scenarios on how we think it's going to turn out. But there's a lot of moving parts. Some of those were seen following the 2013 changes that you made. And here are those changes. I'm not going to walk through all of them, but let me direct your attention to the last bullet there, the last 2013 change. Prior to 2013, the largest Medicaid applicants to the program received an additional award amount for being the largest Medicaid applicants in the program. In 2013, the legislature lowered and then eliminated that bonus. And we'll see how that played out. Let me direct your attention for a moment to the legislative report that's in your packet. And to page 14 of that report. And to the very last paragraph there, which I think tells a lot of the story. So again, once an applicant kind of is eligible for the pool, their grant is largely determined by how much Medicaid revenue they have compared to everybody else. And in 2013, the legislature added six new professions to the Merck program and eligible for support. Some of those professions are trained at teaching hospitals and other high-volume Medicaid organizations. And just the fact of having a change in how they do their training doesn't all on its own change how many Medicaid patients a facility sees or how much they collect from Medicaid. Because of that, a change in their training volume or now being eligible for support of people that they were already training that they couldn't, that weren't eligible before, may not change their grant. Again, because of the Medicaid volume rules. So predicting how these changes are going to play out, as I said, is very imprecise. In addition, Medicaid volume varies year to year. Training activity varies year to year. Who applies varies from year to year. So every year there's a whole, not a whole, but every year there are changes in all of those variables, which in the end affect who gets what. So unlike some other tools that you have available to you, where you can change X and know that you're going to get Y, in Merck, you can kind of change X and know that you're going to probably get close to Y or get fuzzy Y. And again, you've done that. You've made some differences. But again, I think this is when some of the kind of the brows started to get puzzled last time when people were saying, well, wait a minute, you know, if we can't just do this and get that. And so today I'm hoping to explain some of the reasons why that takes place. Turn to the next page in that report, page 16. And here's where you really did make a difference. The legislature removed that 20% bonus over a period of 2 or 3 years. And what you have, if you look at the very bottom of this table, you will see the share of the pool that went to the biggest applicants, the biggest grantees. And you can see that that share did shrink some over time. 2013 is on the right, the way it used to be. 2016 is towards the middle, the way it is now. And you can see that that change, which was a big change, did make a difference. So you have the power to within the current formula, there is the power to make some big changes and get some big effects. It's just a fairly blunt instrument at times. So that's what you can do with the formula. If there's no questions or comments there, I'll move on. Here's another, looking at this pie chart, here's another change that we were able to find in the data. In 2013, you did add mental health providers as eligible for Merck subsidy, and you can, we are seeing some of that in the data. That yellow, that green slice there of mental health providers does include psychiatrists who are already eligible, but it also includes psychologists, social workers who are new to the program. So that's another place where we did make some, the change did make some difference. So on this slide, again, just recapping what you can and can't do through the current formula. Some states have created or changed their health profession subsidy programs by going back to the beginning and doing something new from scratch. The tool to do that, again, if capturing Medicaid revenue is important, and I don't know a state where it's not important, is to do that through the new generation of Medicaid reform waivers. And some states have done that. It hasn't been a health professions move only, but they have included health professions training and education as a component of broader health reform and health transformation Medicaid waivers that they have submitted to the federal government. Not recommending any of these options, I'm just kind of laying out what you have available to you. And finally, you can always invest in health professions, training, education, workforce development outside of the Merck program. Using state money only, you have infinite flexibility. And over the last couple of years, the legislature has done some of that, and that remains an option. The legislature has also put more money into Merck, even though into the Merck formula, even though the Medicaid share of Merck is capped because of the existing state Medicaid waivers. So, not sure this is of that much help today, but file it away for next session or whenever you want to take another look at Merck. You can change the current formula. You can kind of start over from scratch as part of some bigger Medicaid effort, or you can use state funds to accomplish whatever is of interest.
I do have a question, a couple of questions. Based upon the criteria, I assume the VA hospital is not eligible for Merck funds.
Correct.
So how, but it is a source, a lot of residents.
That's correct.
Okay. A lot of residents do their training there. Is that part of the federal VA allocation then for that training, or is that part of our Merck funds that are going towards that?
I'm going to need to phone a friend here, but I believe there's two components of that. One is that, yes, the VA does fund some of that itself. I don't know if the VA qualifies for Medicare GME. Anybody know?
Yeah. Come yes, forward. VA, yeah. Yes. No, please come up. And yeah, thank you. And again, if you could identify yourself.
Yes. Yeah. Chair, my name's Troy Taubenheim. I'm the director of the Metro Minnesota Council for Graduate Medical Education. And to answer your question, yes, the VA Medical Center does get federal funding directly to the VA for graduate medical education. So they are funded separately outside of the funds for Merck and CMS that goes to the other teaching hospitals. Okay.
Can I further ask, how they determine the number of trainees they'll take on then? Is there a formula for that? Or
I'm not sure about the historical formula, but approximately 150 physician resident trainees is what they fund here in the Twin Cities. That number has actually grown and expanded for opportunities across the country, and so the federal government is putting more money in graduate medical education training at the VAs here locally and around the country.
Well, that's good to hear.
It is.
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Thank
You're
you
welcome.
So much. Any other related questions before I ask my second question? Okay. You know, on the PowerPoint presentation where you showed where does the money go? Why do we see some of the disparities between the FTEs and the funding?
Mr. Chairman, that's another core feature of Merck. The short answer is that there are some large graduate medical education institutions that have relatively low Medicaid volume. So because Medicaid rules, that's what their funding is based on.
In looking at this, you know, we've talked about a great deal about underserved areas of the state, especially in outstate Minnesota. And it appears that the funding to train physicians in outstate Minnesota is costlier than in the metro area. Is that a correct assumption?
Mr. Chairman, I've not heard that. I'm not sure how I don't think we know that precisely.
I'm just going off the chart, looking at percentages of costs and then percentages of FTEs.
Mr. Chairman, the dark bar there is the amount of MRC money that a site gets. It's not related to their training costs. Although, I mean, it is somewhat related.
Sure.
But as long as their training costs are less than what they qualify for in MRC, they get what the Medicaid share entitles them to.
It's one of those deep dive questions, I guess. All right. Any other questions people have? We're baffled again on the MRC. But we have someone that has all the questions. He's going to come forward and help.
Mr. Chair, Michael Belzer, Hennepin County Medical Center. I think the simplest explanation is that in the metropolitan area is generally where training hospitals are, and they have a higher Medicaid population than, for example, the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. Mayo Clinic has lots and lots and lots of residents, but a very low Medicaid volume. When you move to outstate and allstate, the Medicaid percentage is much higher than the number of trainees that they have, and that's the cause of the disparities between the MRC funding and the number of trainees. It's just where Medicaid patients reside and where the hospitals and clinics that receive the money are located.
So the funding really is, we're talking about the Medicaid dollars.
Mr. Chairman, this chart should probably, that legend should probably be relabeled. The dark bar is kind of the MRC funds.
Mr. Chair,
thank you.
As a point of history, in the late 90s and around the early 2000s, there was a big dispute amongst the MRC constituents, and the Commissioner of Health that time had to sort that out, Jan Malcolm, about should the money follow Medicaid volume, because it was Medicaid money carved out from Medicaid payments, Medicaid dollars for Medicaid patients, for Medicaid training, or should it follow the trainees? And to make a very long story short, there were a number of formula tweaks, initially 50-50, then it went to two-thirds trainees and a third Medicaid volume until the federal government stepped in, looked at the Medicaid distribution, and declared that it needed to follow the Medicaid volume. So it wasn't a Department of Health decision, and it wasn't a DHS decision. It was a CMS decision, or whatever it was called at that time. So the majority of the funding is tied to Medicaid volume, if that makes sense.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Appreciate the clarification by all of you. Thank you. Any other comments, questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Next item on our agenda has to do with the healthcare workforce governance. Many of you are aware that in statute, this commission ends this year. It was for 3 years. And the question is, going forward, where do we go from here? Are there any recommendations? You have in your packet of information received a letter from a gentleman, Lance, I can't remember his last name, no, Lance Hagelin, who is advocating a continuation
of multi-stakeholder, interdisciplinary, cross-industry governing body that meets regularly to look at monitoring, strategizing, and working to improve healthcare human services workforce needs. So we have one piece of information. You also should have in your packet of information Senate File 1246 that was introduced in 2015. This, again, provided for a comprehensive healthcare workforce council to monitor our workforce needs in the state of Minnesota. It was presented but has not been acted on. So we do have some decisions to make, perhaps, about moving forward in the future. And I'd like to open that up for some discussion. Of course, we can sunset and walk away, or is there a need to continue in some form looking at our workforce needs in healthcare in the state? So any comments? Senator Halverson-Wicklund.
I guess I'll just comment that I do think there is a need for some sustained oversight. I think that if this work ends, we can make the recommendations, but if there's no one to kind of monitor or follow up, it just seems like having some way to, or some group that's overseeing, we won't keep a sustained effort on any given profession or react as well, I think, to what the needs are. So I don't know exactly how that should be accomplished. I thought that the bill that we proposed in 2015 was a good one, but there's probably other ways to do it too.
Okay, thank you. Other comments? I know that in looking at demographic information also from some of the DEED and other groups, healthcare workforce is going to be the fastest growing employment area in our state going forward here in the next 10 years. And the question is, do we want to try to monitor that to make sure we're getting people in the right place in the state of Minnesota, or do we let things just move along without any direction? So, yes. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and understanding that I'm speaking from a position of my time winding down here. So it's just observation from the time spent here that I think there's a balance to strike. I think if there's proposals coming out of here in the next month for the 2017 legislative session, some action items to take action on, work on. I do think there sometimes can be benefit to the people who have served on this committee to committing to keeping an eye on those issues and moving them forward in legislative proposals. Sometimes I think if you keep on building a task force on top of a task force while you're trying to get things accomplished, people feel like something's, you know, like we're getting something done, even though it's not passing the legislature, we're talking about it. So I do think sometimes there's a value in a pause on the task force, put all the effort behind getting the ideas that have come forward so far through and passed, get to a certain point, and then reconvene and keep working. However, that's not to say I don't hear the understanding that there sometimes is a need to have a group that's keeping the discussion alive and active, bringing stakeholders to the table. But I do think that there's a balance to strike there. Sometimes task forces keep going. You lose, things aren't necessarily passing the legislature, but we keep talking about it. And because we're spread thin across the meetings and the discussions, trying to actually get the things done that we've said we want to get done can get diluted or difficult to kind of keep your eye on the prize and prioritize the actual action we need the legislature to pass. So I just think that's something to keep in mind for whatever decision is made going forward. And assuming that for the task force to continue, in the past it's been legislatively passed to create it. So for it to continue in this capacity, I suppose that would be necessary. But an official task force isn't the only way to maintain the conversation, surely. But understand it's probably the most effective to get everybody to the table.
Thank you for those thoughts. And certainly the earlier Senate File 1246 with the council certainly had a broad membership.
And I know when this was proposed, we had lots of people that came forward wanting to make sure they had a voice at the table. So I think what we'll do as we move ahead here, we'll solicit feedback from the commission members and also from the public. And we can make that decision as we move ahead. But it's something I think we need to definitely give some thought to, especially when we look at the needs of the state moving forward. And this is going to be a very large employment area. And how do we make sure that we're training the people, that we have the facilities available, that we have the people in place to make that happen? So we'll definitely put this on our agenda as we work ahead for our priorities and identifying that and see if members agree on direction for the future. The final report outline priorities is the next item on the agenda. Mr. Schoenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, you've got two handouts for this agenda item in your packets. One has final report charge at the top and final report outline first draft in the middle. And the other is headed final report recommendations first discussion. Representative Albright has, you know, encouraged us to kind of get to work on this, and I'm glad he did. So to the kind of the report outline, just for reference, there's the charge from the legislation that created the commission, which calls for a final report by December 31st. Here's kind of a first outline for that final report. Thought there is that because your first two reports were hefty, there's maybe no need to start from scratch and do another big hefty report, but to try and recap what you have done this year, bring forward some highlights from those last two reports and cite them as references, discuss what your accomplishments have been in these 3 years, to do a brief final snapshot of the health workforce lay of the land, and you have heard presentations this fall that should feed into that to try and capture some of the major issues, and then to end with whatever recommendations you decide to make this term. Any thoughts so far?
Comments, thoughts?
So to those, to try and put some shape to your process for coming up with recommendations, you have this other handout. And what this other handout does, it may look, the construction of it may look familiar. It is very similar to where you started this exercise last year. I think last year, I think the co-chairs took a great, had a great insight that not everything you've talked about is a specific recommendation, but some of it is more kind of goals and principles. So that's loaded in here at the beginning of page one. Your priority recommendations where you ended up last year, start that next section with some notes. For instance, to perhaps update the topics that you've discussed about to carry forward past recommendations with updates informed by this year's discussion. A couple of kind of staff thoughts on if you wanted to continue, for instance, recommendations 4 and 5, given the discussion you've had, testimony you've had this year, you know, one way you might want to think about that. As we've just discussed, talking about any next steps in your recommendations section. And then finally, what you've been doing each year is you've kind of identified priorities, and then you've included kind of other recommendations that you thought were important but not necessarily top priorities. And that's carried forward here as well. There's lots of blank lines here. You know, there's opportunities to, so lots of blank lines to add things, lots of opportunities to strike things out. You know, I've already stricken out something on page 3, and it looks like it was just a mistake from last time. And what happened last year was that kind of the co-chairs got this in shape for member review. It was distributed to members. Members ranked recommendations. The co-chairs kind of looked at those results and kind of got it in shape for final commission consideration and action. So I didn't have a better place to start this time. So that's what I've brought for you today. If you're interested in kind of going in that direction, again, I think one difference this year would be kind of to see how far we get by your next meeting, December 6th, and then kind of finish it off by working with the co-chairs and any email communications among and between members in lieu of another in-person meeting.
Very good. And I think, too, that today, to end, we'll have public comments, and hopefully we can have some discussion about the scope of practice issue, which is something that I think we want to include in our final report, and then also looking at the governance and moving ahead with the work of this group. So those are two things that I think we need to include in our final report. I personally like the idea of putting this in some type of a recognizable, workable fashion, and then allowing the commission members to, as you said, identify through their priority system on things that we should move ahead with. Any other comments? All right. Okay. Does that give you enough direction, Mr. Schoenbaum? Hopefully.
I'll get things started and guided by you two.
Very good. Thank you. We did have some time left for public comment. Anyone that would like to come forward, either on today's topics that we discussed or other work of this commission? Seeing none, any comments by the commission members? In that event, then, we are adjourned. Thank you. Thank you.